I think it is a moment when we need a lot more history. That would be my opening statement. And you describe ours as a historical moment in which, conscious of polarization, conscious of the unresolved legacies of white supremacy and slavery, where are we going? What are we going to do about this? And when you bring in Jefferson, what that suggests to me and what I want to hear Annette talk about and for us to consider is, what's the point of talking about Jefferson at this moment, since he seems to represent a past that we are repudiating? That is, Jefferson owned several hundred people. Jefferson had a long-term liaison with an enslaved woman. Isn't this the sort of thing that we want to put beyond the rear view mirror, let it fade over the back horizon? I'm going to say no, and I'm going to say no because I think we need to understand Thomas Jefferson and we need to understand Sally Hemings better. We need to put them into a context that's not our context to get a better perspective on what our context might be.
And we talk about Jefferson and we talk about, you know, the difficulties of these particular times. It's amazing, after 8 years of having the first African-American president in American history, that we are at a point now where some people think that we're on the verge of a race war or something, the kind of hostility that is openly expressed between the races. And it's a very, very polarized time. Jefferson comes to the fore, I think, not just because of the bad things that we think about with respect to him, slavery, his issues about race and so forth, but because of the Declaration of Independence, which is seen as a founding document, a founding creed of America. And people look to that as raising possibilities, a sort of mechanism for hope, in a way, that this is something that King talked about in his I Have a Dream speech in Washington, looking to the Declaration, the words of the Declaration, to say that we have things to do. We have a road to travel. We had a good beginning with that, but have we lived up to it? So I think Jefferson is perfect for talking about the good and bad of the American story and the American legacy. And we like to talk about people and seeing the world through the life of an individual who embodied so many of the struggles, so many of the contradictions that exist in American life is important. It's a vehicle. We don't like to, you know, you don't want to use people as an instrument, but the truth is that he is a way into, is a better way of putting it, a way into some really, really difficult topics about race, about slavery, about religion, about the nature of government, about political participation. Jefferson believed in the people in a way that we have some questions about now. You know, who are the people? How do we constitute ourselves as the people? What are the responsibilities of citizens about political participation? He actually thought that the way out of problems was for the people to get involved. If there were things that they didn't like, you had to work on that. You had to work on it as a community, as political participants. And so he raises a lot of questions and doesn't provide all of the answers, but questions are the most important things in a lot of ways. The right questions can be better in some ways than the answers, so-called answers that are given. And he is a way to do that, to raise those questions and ways for us to consider who we are.
It's Jefferson as a citizen of his time. That's the Jefferson we want to recover. It's not a Jefferson who has all the answers to our problems. It's not the Jefferson who is our problem. It's Jefferson situated, who can suggest things to us, not answers, but as Annette suggests, questions. A very simple point I'd like to make that defines our world perhaps against Jefferson's and that we might think about a little bit more is, Jefferson was deeply interested in the past, interested in the past in a new way. He was looking at Virginia history, at the history of the Western world, to try to figure out what moment he lived in. And to understand the past was crucial. And this may seem self-evident, as he says in the Declaration, but the past, without the past, you can't have a future. We're thinking about time in a linear sense, moving from the Dark Ages to the light of the future. We're in the midst of an enlightenment. For him, a crucial, pivotal moment in world history. Without the sense of that history, you can't make sense of Jefferson. The difference between Jefferson and us is that we obsess about history at the expense of our future. And we want to clean it up. We want to make it work for us right now in our moment. We're looking for Jefferson as a hero or a villain. We need to look at Jefferson and all his fellow Americans, black and white, enslaved and free, in their moment to try to capture a sense of that time so that we can have that more capacious sense of the unfolding of time through generations. His teaching, the thing that mattered most to him, was that there was a future, a more enlightened future, and it would be enacted, it would be realized through the succession of generations. Do we believe that now is a question I ask my contemporaries. Do you believe in a future with the planet shriveling up and global warming, with the kinds of crude right-wing populism that seem to be destroying democratic politics all over the Western world? Do you really believe in progress? And if you did, wouldn't that be something like, well, very close to a kind of almost religious faith in the people? I recur to what Annette said, and I thought it was profoundly true, about Jefferson saw the solution not in his own brain, not in his genius, not that he could lay down the law and solve our problems forever and ever and ever. He saw that if you could mobilize the people as the people were mobilized to win the American Revolution, and that every successive generation would feel the need to mobilize yet again and again and again to own their country, to reaffirm their collective identity, to do the thing needful. That sense of future possibility is something I think we've lost. Instead, we're playing games with the past to define what our own genealogy, and it's almost genealogical if you're thinking in tribalistic terms, that we are a kind of family. And so who's our progenitor and who can claim Jefferson as the father? That's so un-Jeffersonian. There's so many things about Jefferson that are dissatisfying, in which he doesn't meet our lofty standards. Sure, he would expect that. So, where are we going? Do we have a sense? Can we chart a future for ourselves? I think that's the real problem.
Well, in thinking about his life and thinking about Sally Hemings, the story that that tells really is about the nature of American slavery. It was not just a system of people working and not getting paid, and the auction block and the whip. All those things were very, very much a part of it. But it was also an institution that created mingled bloodlines. People were owning their relatives, their half-sisters, their children, their uncles, their aunts. And it's very, very difficult for us to wrap our minds around that, because our conception of family would not allow that, for something like that to happen. But that was the world that he lived in. And the story of Sally Hemings and her family is how they managed under that system, how they made it through that system and were able to stay as a family, keep the family connections, and go forward. And one of the difficult things, someone was asking me about Sally Hemings not long ago, actually a few moments ago after our talk, was this idea of Sally Hemings having any kind of agency. We're thinking about Sally Hemings now in the era of Me Too. Of course, Me Too is the 21st century. It's a contemporary time, and it's not to say that they're not points of commonality, but it's a completely kind of different world, a different structure. We're talking about the institution of slavery. We're talking about a situation, as I said before, where Sally Hemings was the half-sister of Jefferson's wife. From every indication that I've been able to get, Jefferson saw Sally Hemings and her siblings through the prism of his understandings about his wife, from his feelings about his wife. And I can't prove this, but it appears that she had a very different understanding about her siblings. I mean, sometimes when those situations occurred, the white woman involved in that, if her father or a brother or son had children by an enslaved woman, they would want those children to be sent away. They would be gone. They would be sold. But Martha brings them to Monticello. And I really do think that she taught Jefferson, or her example, he saw them through her eyes. We don't know about Sally Hemings, but the sons were literate and apparently at a pretty high level. Who taught them how to read and write? It's probably not Jefferson who did that. I mean, it's much more likely that she or her father or someone in their family who lived with them when they were growing up taught them to do that. And what does that say about the nature of that family? You can't really explore that through history because we don't have their letters. You know, we don't have all of the information. But the fact that they had these skills and these talents, and you think about where they came from, how that influenced and shaped his understanding of his dealings with these people, it gives you a whole different sense about slavery and a different sense about Jefferson, actually. When you compare it to the way the people down the mountain, people who are not Hemingses, were treated, who didn't have the opportunities that they did. So it's a very, very complicated situation, and it doesn't fit neatly with our current day understandings about gender relations, about race. Sally Hemings's father was a white man. Her grandfathers were white men. You know, and we sort of think somehow that she would have had the same sense of racial solidarity or racial understandings as we do. And there wouldn't be any reason for her to do that. So if it were not Jefferson, who would it be? I mean, so it just raises, again, all these questions that we can't really answer definitively, but having a discussion about them or thinking about them, I think tells us a lot about us. I mean, the kinds of things that we value and who we are as a society and are thinking about things at this particular moment.
The black-white binary, which has come to dominate American thinking about race, proves on closer examination to be much more complicated. The racial origins of everybody are, well, do your DNA analysis. Let's see what you come up with. It's a complicated business. People make binary distinctions. They make classifications to cope with complexity, to simplify it so that they can find their way forward. Well, this is a distinction between black and white, the way race has governed our thinking and continues to govern much behavior, that is keeping us from moving forward. And if we can find more complexity in the past, and we can find that even under the brutal regime of racial slavery, a regime in which some people owned other people, and it correlated to some extent with what we call race. Well, if even that is a complicated world, how complicated are we compared to an overwhelmingly agricultural population doing stuff in the dirt and producing crops? A few people who owned other people could do the kind of crops that could make money in foreign markets. And there's some merchants and a few craftsmen. It's a pretty simple world. We live in a really complicated world, and our cultural DNA, you might say, all the inputs that make us who we are, make us very hard to read, but we want to be simple. We want a simple way out of it. Well, the way out of it, I think, and this is the theme that I think we're developing here, is let's understand that all this complexity is a gift. All the people who have come together have produced wonderful things, even in their coming together. And what we need to restore in our way for our times is a sense of the people and the power of the people that is, and we'll say it, Jeffersonian, that is a faith in those people, a people who understand their own history, who understand they are not the direct descendants of a few planters in Virginia, but we're all mongrels. We're all complicated people with diverse backgrounds, and we're doing diverse things. It's not just the racial aspect of it I'm talking about. I'm trying to make the segue into talking about all the things that constitute the people we think we are, our sense of what a self is in the modern world. That's a modern invention. We're working on it. But we can't have that invention. We can't understand ourselves unless we have the capacious context of people we identify with, not because they're like us, but because we are all products of the same history.
Peter S. Onuf is an American historian and professor known for his study of Thomas Jefferson in 1989. He was named the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of the University of Virginia, a chair he held until retiring in 2012. He is one of the founders of the NPR program Backstory. And Annette Gordon Reed is the Charles Warren Professor of American Legal History at Harvard Law School and has published 6 books, including The Hemingses of Monticello and American Family, which won numerous awards, including the Pulitzer Prize in History and the National Book Award for Nonfiction.